3. So the numbers right now, humidity is still high at 84%. Wind is from the northwest at 6. 69 Kenosha, 68 Racine, 67 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
This portion of WGTD's Morning Show is concerned with a very important issue, and in some respects, an issue that is likely to be of heightened importance during this time of COVID-19. One of the things that we have heard about is that this period of in which people are sequestering, social distancing, and so on, has, among other things, very likely exacerbated certain issues that people might have when it comes to, for instance, substance abuse or perhaps alcoholism. And so we are hearing more and more reports about how common this is for people to get into maybe additional trouble or deeper trouble during the stresses and fears that all of us are experiencing during COVID-19. A book that we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes that explores some of this is called Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture, published by She Writes Press. The author, Lisa Boucher, who is a registered nurse, is also somebody for whom the issue of alcoholism is deeply personal, and I'm going to ask her in a moment to kind of explain her own personal connection to this. But she has, in her words, become an expert on a disease she hates. And so she has tasted in more ways than one the pain and destructiveness that so often is a part of alcoholism, and has words of wisdom to share that I'm glad we can share with you in this interview. Again, her book called Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. And Lisa Boucher, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, Greg. Happy to be here.
So let's begin with the directly personal and the way in which alcoholism has been a theme in your life. In fact, you say it so poetically very early in the book when you say, I've been immersed in alcoholism since my first breath of life. Explain to our listeners how the legacy of alcoholism for you goes all the way back to your very first breath.
It sure does. So I was raised with, my mother was an alcoholic. Her addiction started really, like I said, as a small child. I can't remember her ever not using. And my mother was a registered nurse, and her addiction started with Valium, prescribed by a doctor, and that was the pharmaceutical industry's first billion-dollar drug. So her addiction escalated from Valium prescribed by the doctor to, in fact, there's a scene in the book where my father follows her one day and finds out, we used to find pills in the potted plants and hidden all over the house in baggies, like she was getting it from a drug dealer. And so my father followed her, and I said, you know, he regaled us with the trail, with the tale from the shampoo aisle, because he threatened the pharmacist who was handing her this lunch bag, the little brown lunch bags that we used as kids. It was filled with, at the time, we called them Quaaludes. And they made her extremely loopy, but she was getting this from a pharmacist. And there was a big showdown in the drugstore, so you'll have to get the book and read about that with my dad. It's funny, but it's not funny. And so she did not get sober until I was 21. So I, you know, my whole entire childhood was this very chaotic, I mean, I could go on and on with stories that are, it's hard to believe. Some of them are comical and some of them are just tragic, that this woman, beautiful, my mother was a gorgeous woman and smart, and alcohol just took her down so quickly. I mean, the pills, I think she juggled that for a number of years, but once she started drinking, and she was always the kind of person who would have a couple drinks and really could never handle her liquor, so she didn't drink a lot. But when her addiction just grabbed a hold of her by the throat, literally, and she was drinking a fifth a day and passing out, and I would find her often on the floor passed out. And I know my father was very, he could not control this. Disease was just so much bigger. And so he lashed out with a lot of anger, some physical abuse toward us kids, verbal abuse, just a very chaotic, traumatic environment to grow up in because of her addiction. And I know that they did try to get her help. She went to numerous therapists, psychiatrists, psych wards. Nobody ever said, you're an alcoholic. They kept diagnosing her with manic depression and all of these mental health diagnoses, none of which were true, because once she sobered up, she never took another pill other than for high blood pressure. And I'm seeing this in my nursing career. I've worked in emergency rooms and psych wards. And what happened to my mother back in the 60s, sadly, Greg, is still happening today, where doctors are slapping these diagnoses on people when really, when you peel back the curtain, their underlying issue is substance abuse, alcoholism, drug addiction, whether it's prescription drug, it doesn't matter. And often when you address those two issues, people are completely normal and they don't have depression or other things. Now, not in all cases, but so it was just a very problematic. And then I found myself heading down that same path. And so I got sober in my late 20s and I did not hit a low bottom at all. Hence raising the bottom. I also have siblings that are in addiction. So it is, and my first husband was a raging alcoholic. And I talk about that very brief marriage that also, I remember, I'm going to tell you one really quick story about that. I mean, it was a year of just total chaos, but he ended up jumping out the bathroom window when my father came down to confront him from where I grew up in Youngstown, and I was living in Columbus, and he jumped out the window under the guise of taking a shower, and I've never seen him again. I mean, it was just insane how this alcohol was, like I said, I'm like a tea bag, you know, you're just immersed in it. It's touched every facet of my life.
And at one point you say, in describing, I think, particularly what it was like to grow up in such a household with your mother and her struggles, chaos and crises became a way of life that seemed normal. Or, I mean, a life that in so many respects would just seem incredibly stressful and incredibly difficult also becomes oddly normal when that's all that you know, and when that ends up kind of enveloping everything in that life.
That's exactly what happens. And I know in recovery, that concept became very apparent when I did get sober and you realize that there's no more chaos. And I think I was as addicted to chaos as I was the alcohol. And I see that in a lot of people. I work with a lot of women in recovery and a lot of even men that I talk to. We get so used to that chaotic environment that when you get sober and you don't have that, you almost feel like something's missing until you get readjusted and your nervous system and everything has to settle down to normal. Life is not supposed to have constant chaos, constant drama, constant mishaps. Most of people, when they're in their addiction, they're not trustworthy. So you're used to not trusting, and there's always like you're waiting for the shoe to fall, and it usually falls. Whereas in real life, you don't need to wait for the other shoe to drop, because when you're doing the right thing and you're with people that are trustworthy, most of the time the other shoe doesn't have to fall. So it's just changing the whole perspective.
Right. I was so sad when I read early in the book, as a child, if I had to pick one prevalent emotion, it would be fear. And I was just thinking, how sad when that is the predominant emotion in a youngster's life. And of course, that can be the case for a variety of reasons. But in your particular case, it was primarily because of the alcoholism with which your mother struggled, and what that did to her marriage to your father, and the struggles between the two of them, and so on. What was the toll that that fear took on you? I mean, what would be some of the ways in which you bore a heavy cost by living with such fear?
Well, I think when you grow up in that environment, and millions of kids are doing it as we speak for any number of reasons, but it's very hard to self-actualize, to really find out and learn about yourself when you're always in survival mode. And so I think that's why I started to drink early. I mean, I had my first beer at 12 years old.
Wow.
You get that feeling of, It just erases some of that anxiety and that high alert. You're always operating in high alert. And then when I have that fear, and it's like, oh, it's like this release of that fear. And you're not, you know, I remember just being on eggshells all the time, especially more so with my father than my mother. I mean, with her, you never really knew what she was going to do, but she was a very sweet person. Even when she was drinking, she didn't have a mean bone in her body, where my father was the opposite, just very angry. And I think we were all scared of him. I have, you know, two older sisters and a younger brother. And I think the toll that it took on all of us is we all pretty much have our own issues with addiction or something. So you cannot raise children in these environments and not expect them to perhaps seek an outlet. You know, I didn't channel mine in a healthy way. Maybe there are those kids that can channel it and they become exceptionally good in school or some other thing. But my big escape, and I do talk about this too, is I had a horse.
Yes.
I think I would have really gone deeper and been a child alcoholic had I not had that horse, because that then became my escape.
Absolutely. I also appreciated the fact that your father, you write, stayed angry and desperate to dictate and control everything, including my mother's drinking, which was a losing proposition. And you go on to talk about some of the things that he tried to do in a desperate attempt to keep all of this under control. Can you just say a word about that?
Yes, I think there's a lot of people, you know, family struggle. When you have someone who is in addiction, be it alcohol, drugs, food, sex, gambling, whatever the case may be, the people around that person they're living in fear as well. And so my father would do things like mark the bottles, because he didn't drink much. I remember he had a little cabinet with two or three bottles. So he would put a line there to see, and then he could tell if she drank any, and then he could yell at her or something. Well, she would just put water, you know, drink it and then fill it up with water. Or he would he was always wanting to know exactly where she was and things like that. So like that was going to help fix, like he was going to be able to control whether or not she was at the grocery store buying God knows what. I think he was just desperate to fix this. And when, like I said, the doctors didn't seem to be getting it right, she wasn't getting help there, the therapists weren't getting help. I know my dad traveled some in his line of work. He was scared to leave, but then when he was home, he was a rageaholic, and no wonder she drank. So it was just this very toxic environment for all of us. And
right.
My father had no coping skills, and my mother's drunk, and us kids are pretty much just running amok.
At one point you write, mother's outrageous behavior usurped all the attention. My brother and I flew under the radar, doing the best we could to live our lives. All I could think about was graduating high school so I could break free of the chaos. Of course, as you've already said, drinking became very much a problem for you as well. You at the age of, was it your late 20s?
Yeah, yes. I was 29 when I got sober.
And that was back in 1989.
That's right.
Just in a nutshell, I'm afraid, explain the circumstances that brought you to a place where you could say, no more drinking.
Well, it was I think I knew a couple years before I actually quit that I was heading down that path. And I want to make a really clear point here. When I did quit, Greg, even my own husband said, oh, you are not an alcoholic. So nobody believed it because I didn't fit the stereotypical mold that people have in their heads that is not true. So that's why I wrote the people in my book I picked were people that had high bottoms. They're doctors and nurses and moms and teachers and people that we encounter every day. And they had all the outward props pretty much in place, but inwardly their, you know, marriages are falling apart, their lives are disintegrating internally. And so for myself, I started to suspect I had a problem when I was working in advertising and marketing at the time, and I had like a home bar, kind of like my place where I'd go at lunch. And I started, by this time, my mother finally got sober. So she's in recovery and I'm seeing her change from this wreck of a person, literally, to morphing into this amazing woman. And so I learned a little bit about recovery. And so when I noticed that I was going to this bar every day at lunch, and now I'm noticing a progression, because I used to have just a beer or a drink and then I would go back to work and do what I was supposed to do. But it turned into actually sitting there most of the afternoon getting drunk. And I would go back to my own little office and shut the door and have to take a little nap to recover from my liquid lunch. And so I noticed a progression. And that is one of the hallmark signs of you're getting into trouble. If you are someone who had a few drinks on the weekend, okay, fine. Now all of a sudden you're having a few drinks four nights a week. And then pretty soon that four nights a week turns into two drinks to four drinks, four nights a week. There's a progression and you're getting into problem territory, and people don't want to look at it because usually when all this is going on, your life is still not falling apart. Now, maybe you have high blood pressure, or maybe your spouse is starting to get sick of you or your kids or whatever, but there's still not enough to really look at and point to the alcohol. But knowing what I, and seeing what I saw with my mother, when this progression started for me, and then there were some other things. I was in and out of college for 10 years. I mean, who does this? So I couldn't see my, I would change my major. I would do this. I would, every spring, I would drop my classes because it was time to go on spring break or get a tan or whatever. And I couldn't be bothered with my studies. So that's how my addiction was manifesting. I always tell people, if you have adult children that are not launching, look at substance abuse. Are they drinking too much? Is there drugs in the picture? So it was, that was going on. My husband started to say a few things like, well, my emotions were very labile, up and down, and I'm a pretty even-keeled kind of person. So that was very abnormal for me to have these mood swings kind of thing. So that's how it was manifesting for me. And my husband did say that, well, I'm not sure what's going on with you, but you need to get your act together because things are, you just don't seem right. And then of course he's the first person when I say, great, I'm gonna quit drinking. He's like, oh, no, not that. You know, it's like anything but that, because I mean, he lost his best drinking buddy. And I think he wasn't all that happy. And that happens in families too. You know, we tend to gravitate to people. My husband still drinks and he drinks a lot less now because I don't drink, but I'm sure if I kept drinking, we both could have been in probably big trouble with alcoholism, because we tend to find each other, and you know, you find people who like to drink the way you drink, and that's just how it is.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Lisa Boucher about her book, Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. This is a book in which, as we've been talking just now, she recounts a lot of stories about what she experienced growing up in a home with a mother who was an alcoholic. And she herself struggled with a drinking problem until she finally quit drinking altogether back in 1989. She is now a registered nurse and also someone who has done a great deal of study and contemplation about the place of drinking in our culture and the ways in which it can lead people down a road of ruin. So Lisa Boucher, one of the things I don't think we've made clear yet is that in writing this book, which is not just about yourself and your experience and your mother's experience, but this is written to, in a sense, you know, educate and enlighten others about their own drinking. One of the things that it's important to say is that I think you have written this book primarily with women in mind. Tell us the reasons why it's worthwhile to make a distinction between just drinkers in general, men and women, versus women who drink. Are there certain practices or trends that or characteristics that we often see with women drinkers?
There are, and I think, like I said, men have found my book helpful too. I got a tweet from a guy in France, and he's sober because he read Raising the Bottom, and he realized he could relate. So I think men like it because they don't feel threatened. There are a couple men in the book, but primarily it is women. And I did that for two reasons. Number one, clearly that's what I understand. And I know when I got sober, they said, you know, women stick with women, the guys stick with guys, so that you don't get into all that dating and all that craziness. And so I started to then see patterns, you know, and things are a little different for women. And I think the stresses of women trying to have a career and a family can really push some over the edge, because just the demands on one's time is very stressful. And sadly, our culture really encourages drinking. I mean, the whole mommy wine culture, you cannot go anywhere. I walked into Costco the other day, huge display of alcohol pops, you know, for adults. It's just endless. I was in a boutique the other day, and there's, you know, the pillow. The only two things worth chasing are dreams and drinks. I mean, it's ridiculous. And so these are the messages, you know, and we can't forget our kids are seeing this. So children are bombarded. And if this is all we're role modeling to our kids, how can we be surprised when they're finding, you know, they're getting into trouble at a young age too with this? So it's a serious global issue. It is still, alcohol is the most widely abused drug on the planet, full stop. And we really don't talk enough about it, because it's socially acceptable, because we can dress it up to look lovely. We can drink on a pretty patio out of a pretty glass and ignore how ugly the drinking really is when mom or dad starts raging or hitting their kids or driving them drunk or missing their kids' lives. And these are the stories that I hear from men and women. Mm-hmm. The deep regret of not being able, we cannot turn the clock back. We get one chance to be a parent and raise our kids. And it's heart-wrenching how devastated these men and women feel when they realize, wow, I drank for 20 years and I don't even really know my children, because I was so busy with my social life or going to the bar, or, you know, maybe I was home, but I was always in the backyard drinking with my buddies or my girlfriends, and you miss your kids' lives. So I wanted to maybe save somebody else that heartache. And that's why I included there's 10 other stories in the back of the book, because I was hoping that, you know, maybe you can't relate to my story because I did have a higher bottom. So there's 10 other people, and one of them now, John, he's a chemical dependency counselor. I have surgeons, like I said, people that their drinking didn't look bad at all. Going to work, doing surgery, coming home, drinking two bottles of wine a night. The kids go to private school, they're dressed, they're fed. But one of the daughters of that surgeon wrote a letter. I did a whole chapter because I felt like, you know, when I was a kid of an alcoholic mom, not one person ever said, how are you kids doing? How do you kids feel? And I think we still ignore children. Like, what are they, you know, these party parents that we think is so funny, how do these children feel? And I can tell you how they feel. They feel insignificant, unimportant. They don't have anyone to really go to because you can't trust what kind of reaction you will get out of your parent after two or three drinks. Maybe that same sweet parent is now, maybe alcohol makes them snippy. So now you're afraid. You know, you might have said something to them sober and gotten a great reaction. You say that same thing when they're drinking and they flip. So it makes kids very leery and you start withdrawing inside. And I know that's what I did. I believe that's what my siblings did. We just withdrew within and our escape became food or alcohol or drugs. So I wanted to give the kids a voice because that I think that is that weighs on my heart and they deserve it. And there's not enough books out there asking the kids, how do you feel? So two of the doctors, their daughters wrote letters. And I think I know when I had a book signing and there are probably 100 people in the audience and there were tears on many of the people because I think it hit close to home. You know, you don't have to be a falling down drunk to have a negative impact on your kids.
Absolutely. One of the things you say in your book is that the term social drinker is quite problematic, in part because it is so often used as a shield. It is a relatively innocent sounding term that one can use to mask a much uglier reality beneath the surface. And of course, sometimes people can call themselves social drinkers and that's just not honest at all. And that is not a proper characterization. And people sometimes just are not able to be fully honest with themselves about the kind of drinker that they are. What are your thoughts about that term, social drinker? Is it a term we should be, in a sense, discarding altogether? Or just using with greater care?
I think we need to define, Greg, what is social drinking? So let me define it for you. It is someone who can maybe go to a wedding, at Christmas, at a birthday, whatever. You drink and maybe you don't have another drink for a couple months because you can socialize without it. There are people, if you have to have alcohol to socialize, you're not a social drinker. So I think we need to quit. Like you said, we lie to ourselves. And this is what we do. I did it. I was a social drinker when I'm drinking every night. That's not normal. Or I'm drinking. That's not true. I did not drink every day, but I drank probably 5 out of 7 days in the week. So because I didn't drink every day, I told myself there's no way I have a problem because if I was an alcoholic, I would drink every day. I did not wake up drinking. I did not have any shakes. I didn't have, really anything that would point other than I knew for me, it was abnormal. So when we're now, the new thing is I was doing another radio show and the host was talking about she lives up there in DC area. And she said, it's so disturbing that she goes with her husband to a microbrewery. And she said, all you see is strollers, parents and toddlers running around. Like, we've lowered the bar. That is new. Even when I was raising, I raised twin boys. Okay. There were a lot of women drinking back then when my kids were little, but by God, I cannot, even the ones that are drinking heavily now, I can't think of one of them who were sitting around play dates having wine. So that's all new. And it's become part of the culture and people justify it. And I said, well, what world do we live in where a mom is going to go drink for 2 hours with her friends and then drive the babies home? Like, why? How is that okay? It's not. You're drunk driving. Even if you're not completely drunk, you're not safe. And we've normalized this in our culture to take kids to microbreweries. There was another thing I saw online. I put it on my Instagram, and these parents were upset that there wasn't enough seating for them to bring their kids to these beer gardens. And I said, this is outrageous. So these kids are crammed into strollers and expected to sit there for hours on end so mom and dad can drink. I mean, how selfish do people have to be? And I think that's what it is. I think a lot of the parents are incredibly selfish, and if that offends someone, I'm not really sorry about that, because I see it, and I will say it again. We have to think more about the kids than we do whether mom and dad are having fun. If you want to go drink, go drink. Get a babysitter and go have your fun, Uber home, and be done with it. And if you can't do that, then your drinking is not so social.
By the way, although your book is not about this, I wonder if you would just say a quick word about you as a mother of twin boys that you've mentioned once briefly, who I remember from, I think, the acknowledgments. You say that they've turned out very well, both fine athletes and good guys. So I'm just curious, given your own background, did you have any particular strategies when it came to helping your sons navigate their way through a world in which drinking is so often seen as acceptable, and in certain athletic circles is often very much a part of the mix?
Absolutely. Yeah. Both my sons, they played football all through high school and then college at a Division I school. And, you know, like I said, they were raised with the yin and the yang, because my husband drinks. And there, when the boys were younger, he was probably drinking heavily, maybe a bit abnormally. So they saw that. And then here's their mom who's sober. And I can tell you, though, it was, I talked a lot to them about alcohol. So they knew how I felt. I had a zero tolerance policy in our house with, you know, we had a swimming pool when the kids were teenagers. And so I remember one time we always had a house full of kids. And somebody though was drinking, because I found it, and I pretty much told them, you're going to step up who's ever booze this is, and you're going to leave, and the rest of you kids are all going to leave too if whoever's alcohol this is doesn't claim it. And the kid did, and he left. So the kids knew, okay, this is not, they were always welcome there, they're going to get fed well, but this is not the house to come to if you want a party. Now, did they probably get away with stuff? I'm sure they did. I mean, my one son, he said, Mom, we had to work really hard to get around you. Now, I know they did. I mean, because you got to go to sleep at some point. But for the most part, they were really good. And I think a lot of it had to do with their sports. They excelled at sports. And I thank God for the coaches that, you know, won't let them drink and all that. So I have to give credit to a community that was around them. They went to a Catholic school. We knew everybody. And I told them, you know, we're going to find out. If you're doing something, we might not find out in a day, but within the week, we'll know. So they kind of knew. And like I said, I think sports probably did more for them than what I did. But I do know I have a great relationship with them. They are great men. They both graduated college. They've got jobs. My one son is married. We have a granddaughter now. She's 3 months old. And, you know, I wish they didn't drink, but they do. And I do see some of the isms, the personality tendency in them. But I think what I gave them that I didn't get was coping skills. And that is something, so they know, and they've been through some stuff. They both have had some real heartaches with injuries and surgeries and job changes and all of, you know, life. And they were able to handle it. And so when we would talk, I'd say, well, how are you doing? How are you handling that? They both golf. They both work out, they'll do yoga. So they learn to do some of those things. Will they get in trouble with alcohol down the road? I don't know. I don't know what life, because they have that genetic predisposition, but they do know what recovery looks like. They've met, I remember I had a mocktail party once out by the pool, and I really did it for my one friend, a physician, Fiona, in the book, and she used to say, well, how is it ever going to be fun anymore? So I thought, well, we'll have this mocktail party. And so everybody came, and they looked like anybody else at a cocktail party, only there was no alcohol. And I remember one of my sons whispering, I think they were about 15, and he's like, Mom, are all these people alcoholics? And I'm like looking at him, and he said, they don't look like it. I'm like, well, no kidding, kids. They're just regular people. So I'm glad that they saw that, you know, so those stereotypes and that. Hopefully, I don't see how they could possibly have it, because I've had alcoholics in and out of our house their whole life, and they look like you and me, you know, so regular people with jobs and families. And so that's the difference.
Very good. In our last couple of minutes, I want to just give you a chance to touch on maybe a couple of the most important words of advice that you would have for somebody who perhaps senses that this might be a problem in their own life. And in particular, that subtitle of your book about making mindful choices when it comes to drinking or choosing not to drink at all. But what would be your advice in terms of helping somebody to be more mindful about their choices when it comes to this?
Well, I think you said it best, Greg. We have to be honest with ourselves, because there is absolutely no recovery, no change, no nothing, if we're not honest about, wow, I'm drinking too much, or I feel like my drinking could be getting out of control. And that's a great place to stop. Why does it have to get horrible? You know, we have this little saying in recovery, you can get off the elevator at the 14th floor. You don't have to crash in the basement. And so I would say, and this may surprise some, but my biggest piece of advice was, don't run to your doctor for help for your drinking problem. Find a friend who is successfully doing recovery. Or if you have a doctor who is familiar with recovery, but sadly most of them aren't. And even the new doctors that are, you know, I know a doctor, she's in her first year of residency. I asked her, what are you guys getting in school regarding substance abuse? She said, nothing. We can opt to take a seminar. That's crazy. Where we are with what happened with the opioid epidemic, during this COVID pandemic, alcohol sales are up 300%. You have people committing suicide, drinking wildly because they're realizing, oh my God, I mean, like you said, when opening, there's a lot of fear going on. Women are being asked to do their job and homeschool, and all the seven people are just drinking. And the restaurants, you know, I understand it. They need to make their bar sales are probably what keeps them afloat. So then our governor here in Ohio made it okay where you can get drinks to take out with your to-go order of food. So it's such a priority in our society. But I would tell people, seriously, don't run to your doctor, because what they do, and I'm seeing this in my work, and I have a whole chapter in my book about doctors, nurses, and healthcare, because they steer people wrong and they over-medicate them. And they don't address the drinking. I've heard doctors tell women, you're too young and pretty to be an alcoholic. Don't worry about it. I mean, that's insane. You've got somebody, that little voice inside, we know when we're off the rails. And that little voice was talking to me 2 years before I chose to listen to it, because it's not something anybody wants to just accept and change, you know, take this big lifestyle change. But when you have physicians saying things like that, and I can tell you as an RN sitting in treatment team, listening to psychiatrists, it's like throwing darts. And honestly, they don't care as much as people like to think they do, because they're ready to go home to their families and they're planning their vacations and they're ready to go to their kids' soccer game. And they're not really thinking that much about what happens to you when you leave their office with a prescription. And the doctor's just hoping it might help you. And 9 times out of 10, when your issue is substance abuse, none of those prescriptions are going to be helpful. So I would say, do not run to your doctor looking for the magic pill to fix your life. There is no such thing. It takes work. And if you think you're drinking too much, you should call a rehab. You should go to AA. You should listen to podcasts. There's a lot of information online. You know, delve into it and just really explore it. And there are other recovery modalities that have worked for some people, like Smart Recovery or Refuge Recovery, whatever. So you can find your path, but I very rarely see it happen through a doctor. Once in a while, if the doctor is familiar with substance abuse, the best thing they can say to a person is you need to go to a meeting, like the courts do. The courts do a much better job when they make people go get their paper signed. I know a lot of people who have found recovery because the court sent them to a 12-step meeting. And not everybody, but a lot of those people end up identifying after having to go to enough meetings, and they hear enough people talking, they sit there going, well, my God, they're talking about me. And these people get sober. So that is what I would suggest, is be very, very careful running to the doctor, because what happened, as I said earlier, to my mother is still happening. And she, 25 years of going to doctors, and not one of them helped her. And it's not changed much. So that's very sad.
Right. I appreciate that you take a moment in your book, more than one moment, to talk about what a wonderful person your mother was when she wasn't caught up in her drinking. And that reminds us that that's part of the cost of all this, is when somebody is abusing alcohol, it is in a sense keeping them from being their best self.
It really is, because here's what else. Alcohol impacts directly the prefrontal cortex. This is where our computer is, right behind our forehead. That is our higher reasoning. And when you drink, you are operating now on a more of a reptilian level. So this certainly explains why people end up having affairs when they're under the influence, why people commit crimes under the influence, because their higher reasoning center has been shut down. And so now you're operating on just your sheer carnal desire kind of thing, and people make a lot of bad choices. And I can tell you, I made a lot of bad choices when I was drinking and did things and said things that I would never think of doing sober. So, you know, and I love alcoholics. They're amazing, really smart, passionate, energetic, and just really great people that addiction, you know, takes down. So yeah, we don't understand who we are until you put down the drink or the drug. And then you get to learn who you are.
And who you were really meant to be.
Exactly.
Well, your book is certainly a book that has a lot of powerful information to offer up. Lots of different stories beyond your own, your story and that of your mother. Stories of other people who have contended with this issue in one way or another. And it's a book that also is filled with helpful advice and suggestions for people, to help people discern whether or not this is an issue, and some of the things that that they should probably seek out in terms of help and resources to help them better contend with something that, if not taken care of, can so easily destroy one's life and all that you hold dear. The book again is called Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. The book is published by She Writes Press and the author, Lisa Boucher. Lisa Boucher, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I thank you for writing a book of such disarming honesty and such illumination of this important issue. Thank you again for being part of the morning show, and best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And to finish out the morning show today, I want to return to this notion of social drinking and talk a little bit more about what a trap that can be. And I can remember on more than one occasion talking about the concept of social drinking with Gwida Brown, who is executive director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. And she's agreed to come on the morning show to just offer a few thoughts on this. Guida Brown, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
So I'm sure you're as familiar with that phrase of social drinking as probably anybody I know. So tell us your concerns, the kind of trap that label of social drinking can represent for people.
Well, if I, in Wisconsin particularly, we just drink too much. And so if I think that I'm being social, or if I think that my friends are being social and I'm drinking the same as they are, it's likely not social drinking. Social drinking is defined by the government, the CDC, as no more than one drink for women and no more than two drinks for men on a given day. And no more than seven in a week for women and no more than 15 in a week for men. And when people say that they drink socially, what they mean is that they overdrink. I mean, I think there are very few people across the board who are meeting those standards if they are regular drinkers. And that's the problem. That's the huge problem with the idea that, well, I drink socially, I drink like everybody else I'm socializing with. That's not what it means.
Right. That's not how we measure whether or not this is a problem. One of the things that is mentioned in Lisa Boucher's book is that maybe one should think about when you are with a certain group of people, can you even conceive of not drinking with them? Could you possibly be social with them without taking a drink? And if the answer is honestly no, then there's a problem.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. We have a very skewed notion of what appropriate drinking is in our culture.
So your word, I think, is it that social drinking is okay if we understand what social drinking is, or would you just as soon banish that terminology from our language altogether?
I think it's more of a semantics, yes. And if people really understood what social drinking was, then I have no issue with it. I don't know what we would exchange it with, quite honestly. But we really have to do a much better job of educating people about what it means to be a social drinker.
Guida Brown is Executive Director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. I appreciate you weighing in on this important question. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
This weekend, the podcast version of The Morning Show will include an interesting conversation from 2006 with Lisa Phillips, the author of a book called Public Radio, Behind the Voices, which examines the life and career of some of the biggest names in public radio, some of them sadly no longer with us. But it's a very interesting book and an interesting conversation that we will be replaying tomorrow as part of the podcast of The Morning Show. You can subscribe to the podcast via all the platforms of podcasts, including Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. Be sure to search for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Next week, for our broadcasts, you'll be hearing my conversation newly recorded with Thomas W. Jones, the author of From Willard Straight to Wall Street. Thomas W. Jones was one of 80 black students at Cornell University who occupied Willard Straight Hall. A few years after his graduation, he was having a successful career, incredibly successful career, on Wall Street. His memoir is the story of his intriguing life's journey. Carthage College's Art Sear will join us on Tuesday with his own analysis of current events and issues. On Wednesday, Tiffany Cross, the author of a book called Say It Louder, which is about the place of African Americans in our democracy. I'll also be replaying on Wednesday a conversation I recorded a few years back with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Thomas Meacham, his book Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. On Thursday, more from Guida Brown from the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse, and I'll replay a conversation with television's Kevin Sorbo called True Strength, My Journey from Hercules to Mere Mortal, and How Nearly Dying Saved My Life. And next Friday, a week from today, Donald A. Norman and a fascinating book about the concept of design called The Design of Future Things. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs.